Hey everyone, Zubin Damania. Welcome to the Z-Dog MD show, the podcast version. Exciting, exciting. So by the way we do these shows, and today's is going to be really fun actually, because we're talking to a young entrepreneur who is a Stanford medical student for the past 10 years, okay? And he's founded already two companies that have made a big difference. We're going to talk about AI. We're going to talk about solving the problem of medical errors and how difficult it is, because medical errors are a human error that can be assisted by systems changes. And until we understand that, we're going to have a big problem. We talk about how hard it is to make money improving quality. You can make money improving productivity and throughput and RVUs and billing, but you can't make money improving quality, which is the dumbest thing that could ever exist. And yet that's our healthcare system, right? So anyways, the way we do these shows is we often will stream from our studio in my garage in the Silicon Valley live to Facebook or YouTube, depending. And then we'll take a high-res copy and put it up on YouTube, put it on my website, zdogmd.com, and send it to SoundCloud, where it goes to every podcast platform in existence. So you can catch it in many different formats. And if you're a subscriber to the show, a lot of times you can get content that's early or exclusive, live shows with me, that sort of thing. And you can subscribe on Facebook to support the show, YouTube to support the show, and Patreon. I like YouTube and Facebook the best because you get an immediate bang for your buck, because you get exclusive content right there and a supportive tribe of people that really want to be there. So good conversations and a sort of a really cool discussion group on Facebook called the Supporter Tribe, where it's only people who are subscribers. So generally pretty nice to each other, highly moderated by me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so today is the last show in the series, JP Morgan Health Conference Week. So Marty McCary, New York Times bestselling author, amazing work he's done on quality, pancreas, groundbreaking pancreas transplant stuff at Hopkins, just generally a super smart and accomplished guy, but also a really funny dude and rapidly becoming one of my good buddies, has been co-hosting the last two shows, and this is the third in the series with him. This is a particularly important show for him because he cares so much about quality improvement. So without destroying physicians, right? So metrics on the back of us is just more we have to do. But if we can actually have quality improvement science that actually improves our lives as well and the lives of our patients, that's really what we need. So today, Pelu, our medical student entrepreneur, is going to talk about his companies, Augmetics, that he initially worked with, and now Ferrum Health, F-E-R-R-U-M Health. And you can find that at ferrumhealth.com. And all the things we just said we would talk about and more, and we have a damn good time. All right, guys, without further delay, it's the Z-Dog MD show, co-hosted by Dr. Marty McCary, featuring Pelu Tran. Enjoy and share, please. I don't know, Marty, we're back. Do you think we're live? I can never tell if we're live.
I think we're live, and we're live with Pelu.
Hey, Pelu, guys. What up, dog?
What up?
Listen, okay, I want a name. I want a name like Pelu, because you can reduce your entire name to just one. You're Pelu Tran,
yeah,
but we could just call you Pelu, like the soccer player or like Madonna, you know, like I'm Z-Dog, but not really. Have you ever thought about just getting rid of the last name entirely?
Pelu.
I feel like I need to be much, much, much more famous. And then I can get like the little C next to the bottom right of my name.
Well, you're about to be famous here. Yeah. You're about to get the Z-Dog bump.
You're going to get, yeah, the Z-Dog bump, which is actually a negative bump. So actually, however many followers you had on Twitter or whatever, they start to go away. But you know, for people who don't know, and I always intro this on the audio podcast separately, but for the video guys, mm-hmm. people don't know who this guy is. How you connected with this guy, and Marty was like, Z-Dog, you got to interview Pelu. And I'm like, Marty, what do you mean? 1.21 gigawatts. I've always wanted to say that because your name is Marty, because Marty McFly. But you told me this guy who's a Stanford medical student for the last 10 years. I mean, to be a medical student for 10 years, I could hardly handle it for four. I wanted to die. He's done it for 10, has started two companies, is changing the way we think about medical errors. And the thing is, the way we think about medical errors is we're in denial about it.
Yeah, we're trying to beat ourselves up, and you know, this number's wrong, and here's a better estimate than your estimate, and we play these academic games, and it's like, look, people are getting hurt. Doesn't matter if it's the third leading cause of death, or fourth leading cause of death, as the IOM suggested, or the ninth leading cause of death, people are getting hurt out there.
Yeah, I don't understand this distinction between people are upset, it's not really the third leading cause of death, it's the ninth leading cause of death. Okay, we are killing patience, because we're not accepting the fact that we're human and we make errors. We beat ourselves up. We're scared of malpractice. We're highly competitive individuals. And then this kid from Stanford shows up with an engineering degree, started his first company, Augmetics, like $20 million plus company. I forget how much. Tell me.
I think we raised over $70 million at the time that I started Ferrum.
And Augmetics was kind of designed to use Google Glass to actually be in the room with patients, acquire data, video, and help take the crap off doctors' plates. So you're already making the attending physicians' lives easier.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty popular company with my professors at Stanford, just because all of them hate writing notes also. And so I was like, yeah, I'm going to start a company. We're going to write your notes for you. We're going to save you 15 hours a week of time. And that was the main reason why they let me leave and stay leave.
Yeah, you're like, save medicine or you don't get to come back. Like, have they ever told you that?
Actually, that's literally the conversation that I have with the kind of performance committee at Stanford. They're like, they say each time, so what have you accomplished for us this year?
$70 million, that's okay, but to go for $200 million next round.
Yeah, you know, you're aiming low, son. And they'll call you son because they're going to belittle you that way because they're old. But so you did Augmetics, and it was this amazing thing. And I actually remember my friend Albert Chan was on the cover of something using a Google Glass. He was a glass hole, which was what we used to call the people.
I think it was this small newspaper called the Washington Post, actually.
Something like that. Yeah. That liberal rag, the Washington Post.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, you heard of it? Yeah, you live in Washington. You probably, because they're probably down the street or something. But I remember reading about this going, oh, this is a really interesting company. And you were working with my old clinic, Palo Alto Medical Foundation. Mm-hmm. And so I had no idea you ran that. And now you're working on something that actually is a kind of, and yesterday we talked about buzzwords, right? Artificial intelligence is a play to use AI. Just don't say that you're putting AI on the blockchain to prevent cyber attacks. Because if you do that, you use every single buzzword of JPM. You're using AI to actually detect and prevent medical errors at a systems level. And so tell me, how did you even get into that? Like, how was that an interest of yours?
Yeah, so I guess when I was at Augmetics, we had a lot of conversations with healthcare leaders, people at Sutter, Dignity, et cetera. And we realized that there was this growing chasm between doctors and administrators. Or doctors.
No, come on. I don't know what he's talking about.
And doctors were getting outnumbered. They're like 10 to 1 now.
Keep going. This is new to me.
Yeah,
keep
let's
going.
Put up the chart of doctors versus administrators.
No, but basically every single change of healthcare, it seemed like it had to go through the hands of doctors, and doctors were basically more under fire. Right, that was actually why I started Augmetics, was because I was like, okay, like we can't keep piling stuff on doctors' plates. We need to take stuff off.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things that we saw was basically all the responsibility for patient care, follow up, diagnosis, like. It was all on the doctor. And so you have these mounting pressures of an increasingly complex healthcare delivery system. Patient journeys are getting ridiculous in terms of the path they have to go through. And it's kind of all on the doctor. And so we said, listen, like...
And the nurses.
And the nurses and the care coordinators.
We rely on them to prevent errors. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everybody.
Yeah. And so we basically said, listen, like, why is every single technology that we're trying to deploy in healthcare trying to be shoved into the provider's workflow? Why can't we build solutions that actually help take the burden off, like Augmetics, where we help write their notes for them, or like with Ferrum, where we actually provide them with a safety net, right?
So like Augmetics was like a scribe ahead of its time, and it was automated, if you will. I mean, it helped with the documentation burden. It is a
telemedicine company where we use actually at this point Google Glass, smartphones, tablets, to stream the patient conversation to an assistant sitting somewhere else in the world. So somewhere like India.
Okay.
So that was Augmetics.
And then that assistant is maybe taking, constructing a note, following up, doing things like that.
Yeah.
So it's AI by proxy or AI
square. Yeah, artificial intelligence.
That's right.
Yeah.
We were talking about the
these
other day.
These lights have AI in them.
They do. Actually. They're actually Alexa on the blockchain as well. Are they
influencers?
Now you're hitting close to home, Elu. We're both Stanford boys. We know about it.
So did you make a lot of money on that first company?
It's still running, right? I mean, Augmetics is still scaling. At this point, 30 plus health systems, thousands and thousands of employees. And so for me, it's still a story that hasn't finished yet.
It's a never-ending story with the dragon that flies. Exactly.
Hopefully.
Well, so it's interesting though, because you have an engineering background. You went through medical school. When did you decide you were going to start a company and start deferring
So it was a very slippery, greasy slope into not being in med school. I'd always had these little side projects. My background was mechanical engineering, and so I had always done these little like gadgets, you know, like, oh, it's just like a origami like IV catheter that won't clot. It's like stuff like that, right?
Cool.
And at one point, when Google Glass came out, we happened to like acquire a pair, and we had this like crazy idea, which was like, listen, like I'm a med student. My primary job is writing notes for my doctors. This should be a company.
Good med student.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, and yeah, so we, good med student, right?
So we had like a side project where I literally went to Doximity. I looked at every single doctor in a 200 square mile radius, and I said, hey, like, we want to do like a fun thought experiment. Like, I want to see if I put a Google Glass on you, I want to see if your patient's going to flip out. And then, you know, the reason is because we want to, one, do a social study on this, and two, because we thought that we might be able to do stuff like write your notes, you know, raise information, do all this valuable tools for doctors. And so the only doctor who responded was this guy, actually, you know, still a huge champion, Angus Matheson up in Wairika. Which is
Wairika?
Wairika,
yeah. Wairika. Excuse me, what does that mean,
dude? Wairika is like where they grow like weed before it was a thing, man. Like Wairika is the bomb up there. So this guy Angus,
yeah.
So Angus was like, "Give me a Google Glass, and I'll change the world."
And so it was literally, we gave him a Google Glass. His phone was in his pocket. He literally was on a voice call to me. I was in his room, and I was running his notes for him. Yeah. And that was the Augmetics. And it turns out doctors really like it when you write your notes for them. And so we just kept just scaling. You know, first customers were Dignity and Sutter, and just kept going from there. But
I just had an amazing vision, dude. So this is our next company. An army of medical students all working in a basement, tons of Google Glass, and them just like monkeys transcribing the Bible, but actually
with free pizza.
Actually, no, like more carb heavy, like, you know, like corn dogs, that pasta that the drug companies used to serve us at morning.
You can bump it up to Subway.
So that's post Series A.
They'll do it for free.
So that was the basic premise that started you on the Augmetics route.
And I think one of the things that we, like an opportunity that we saw was that just doctors were, you know, like they were like, the epic list of alerts you have to deal with are just never ending, right? They're like 20 alerts for each patient. They were all basically completely ignored.
Alarm fatigue.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, it's like, there's probably a better way to fix all these like gaps in care, these misdiagnoses, these errors. Doctor's not the right place, right? And so that was kind of the germination of Ferrum, where we said, listen, like, if we're not gonna be able to change every single doctor to make them perfect, and if they're gonna continue to be human, then we need to build systems around them that support them for the inevitable time when they make mistakes.
And this is Ferrum, F-E-R-R-U-M, like ferrous or iron. How'd you come up with the name? We hired a consultant and he said,
This is embarrassing.
Periodic
so,
table.
Back in the day,
do you remember there's a periodic table?
The company's name is Ferrum. Come on.
Well, he wanted to call it molybdenum, but that was already taken.
We were looking for like a short word that had, you know, relative awareness around, but that had the .ai available.
Oh, that's why I became Zdog MD, because Zdog MD.ai was available.
And
I was
exactly. Like, you know, which is horrifically embarrassing. And then like 3 months later, I'm like, okay, FerrumHealth.com is available. Let's snatch that one up because it's way more respectable. So we're now Ferrum Health. .com.
Got it.
But from the AI still redirects to it.
What percent of Stanford medical students have a company? Or does anyone not have a company?
I think everyone has an idea that they're. What's kind of Hollywood? Like everyone has like a script. You know, you have a film that you're shopping around. Like everybody has. Something.
I have a script. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, interviews and. But I think it's really the challenge with Stanford is, and this is a complete digression, is that like I think Stanford Hospital is incredible, but it definitely doesn't reflect American healthcare. So a lot of these companies are like, well, you know, like I have this idea for like delivering better cell therapies to this one subset of like that blood cancers. And it's like,
so this this whole endeavor though was emotional for you.
Yeah.
You lost your grandmother, was it?
My uncle actually. Yeah. So I actually was born in the US, but I went back to Taiwan for a few years as a kid and was raised by my uncle for a couple of years. And about like 6 to 9 months into starting Ferrum, we had launched a few pilots in Asia just to get started. And one of my trips there, I discovered that my uncle had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And, you know, the first product we launched was a tool to try to identify missed diagnoses of cancer. And so, you know, grabbed his record and looked at his medical history and like, he's a heavy smoker. So every single one in the past 5 years, he had gone in and gotten an X-ray or CT scan for lung cancer screening. And in four of the past 5 years, the lesion was present on the X-ray and was missed by the doctor, even though he was being screened for it. And so year five, you know, he loses 20 pounds, becomes cachectic, goes in, gets a CT scan. They find, and it's like, you know, like a 1.5 centimeter, like, you know, like spiculated lesion, metastasis to the liver, et cetera. And so he basically passed away like 6 months after that. And I was like, well, like, can we curse on this show?
Yes.
I was like,
fuck yeah.
I was like, well, like, shit, like, if we had started Ferrum like 5 years ago, right, and we had these systems in place, like, there's no way it would have been caught. Like, maybe we'd have missed it once, but like, at least like year two, year three would have been able to find it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, very rapidly became very personal for me, even though originally it started off as like a philosophical engineering exercise, right? It was like, oh, like, you know, like, in theory, all these medical errors occur, and what if we had systems that could solve them? And then, like, you know, we build it, and immediately it hits home.
Do you get confused who to blame when you get angry, like with your uncle's case?
I feel like I've been in healthcare for, you know, veterans, so been in here for so long as a 31-year-old. but like it's you know, every doctor I know is, and every, you know, practitioner, provider I know is like you're in healthcare because you want to save lives. You're in healthcare because you want to do, like, it's not, it's a system issue, right? And so to try to blame the doctor, or try to blame the radiologists, you know, that's not the right way.
And the other thing is that, and we're going to get back to exactly what Ferrum does, but like, the other thing is that blame doesn't work. So it's been kind of looked at, when you blame people, they actually become more defensive. They make more errors. If you tell somebody, don't make errors, they actually make more errors. So we need this kind of just culture process. We need a blameless environment where we can look at the systems and go, okay, there is a human error. What allowed that human error to happen? Mm-hmm. And is it a training issue? Is it that this human is malicious, that something's going on? That's a different thing. Then it becomes a punitive issue. Then it's like, we have to deal with this person, but that's unusual. So what you're saying is, well, let's then create technology that makes the human error unlikely. And listen, it doesn't just help patients, although that's important. It helps us, because if it prevents us from sitting up at night going, I killed somebody, I didn't mean to do it, I'm a horrible human being.
Terrible feeling. I felt that.
Me too. It's the worst feeling in the world. And you question everything, right? If you can do that, why would we put up roadblocks? I think the biggest roadblock is denial. We don't make mistakes. Because the way you protect yourself against that emotion is you just deny it.
Yeah.
So tell me what Ferrum does that's actually making this better, because I don't understand the technology.
Yes,
so cool.
There are I think at this point, over 700 AI companies that are out there, 500 of them are machine vision. This is our friends at NVIDIA shared the stat. I think it increased by 200 companies in the past year alone. Wow. Just some metrics.
Is that including ZDog Industries? Because they have AI.
We have AI. We have a robot eye that is able to detect haters well in advance of them actually hitting the hate button. So,
But basically we recognize that, you know, you have all these really powerful predictive algorithms that are out there for basically like all these conditions under the sun now. And we saw, rather than try to shove all this information and data into like the mouth of the doctors, like it's like you're trying to make foie gras, let's actually deploy them in the background. Let's run all these analytics and all these kind of predictive algorithms, these diagnostic algorithms, to look for diagnoses across an entire population level. So, you know, lung cancer, let's figure out which small number of the 10,000 scans that a Sutter Health performs per month, which ones have a significant lesion, right?
A concerning lesion that could represent a cancer.
And then, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen with that lesion? It would be if the doctor's note said that it wasn't there. And so we actually not just run these kind of diagnostic algorithms, we actually run natural language on the doctor's note to look to see if they caught it. And so we're looking for these very small number of cases where there's a cancer in the image, but the radiologist report, the dictated document says lungs are normal. And so it turns out that happens a ton, actually.
That's horrifying and unsurprising. One thing I'd ask, though, because I mentioned this to my wife yesterday, she's a chest radiologist, and she's like, wait, but are they making sure that these lesions that they're correlating to know nothing in the note, right? Yep. That those are actually cancer, or that they're a nodule that was already recognized as benign, and so on and so forth. Yep.
And so that's a great question. And I I didn't quite graduate med school yet, so I'm definitely not allowed to opine on this.
Can we pimp him? We should pimp him, right?
Oh, what chromosome is hereditary dwarfism on?
Oh, God.
Eye cell disease. What's the metabolic cause?
Can you believe they ask that shit on exams? Yes. USMLEs. Mm-hmm. Who gives a shit what chromosome something is on?
I love how we totally derailed him to go on this rant. I used to work for first aid for the boards. It. You know first aid for the boards.
Oh, right? My God, yeah.
Which boards have you taken so far?
Step one.
Oh, the one, that you study for months, and then step two is like 2 weeks, and then step three is a number two pencil. So I would write these questions. Vikas Bhushan ran this company in Taulay, first aid for the board. I became friends with them, UCSF guys. I would fly down to his place at Bel Air. He would feed all this army of medical students this junk food and Indian food, and he's like, hey, have fun, guys. Also edit all this material for free. So we would do it. Well, I think he paid us like some nominal fame and, you know, citation in the thing. Oh my God, I'm published in first aid. And I just realized most of it is abjectly useless information.
And you can look it up on the internet. I mean, they have computers now.
What?
Where if you need to know what chromosome is hereditary dwarfism on, you could type it into computers now connected by the internet. Please tell the USMLE test tape makers and the AAMC and the Graduate Education Council, please tell them that we have computers and we're stuffing our med students' creative brains with this useless SHIT that we
That's
can
otherwise shit.
Be using to explore creativity and do cool things like what you're doing.
Can I make one more thing before we let him talk about his life's passion? what if we made step one an open internet test where you had the internet, but you had to sort through the garbage on there to get the right answer?
That would be brilliant.
Wouldn't that be crazy? Because what a doctor has to do.
Or only make you memorize things you need to know in emergencies.
Exactly right.
The slippery slope would be like, then you make step one about how do you write a SOAP note, right?
And then, how to click the boxes in Epic.
Yeah, like pimping you on, like, what's the difference? So how many elements of the, you know, review systems you need for a 99213? Quick, go.
Oh, my God. Billing.
So that's billing, terrifying. Billing. I would not want to do
that. So back to the question about,
Wait, so you not only catch lesions that are missed by a radiologist's report, but also if it's in the report and there's no follow-up, that is another gap in care that you identify. And it's not like you're bad or wrong. It's here's a list of patients that at your hospital where there was a lesion missed on the report or a lesion on the report that did not have follow-up. Yeah. And it's just in sharing information. It's creating a safety net.
Yeah, and actually, like, it's not just cancer, it's not just radiology, right? Basically, any diagnostic error is going to be quantitative data that reflects it in the record with a subjective information, right? A diagnosis or a note that doesn't.
So let me reiterate this so I can make sure I understand. You take like lab or diagnostic data that is actually objective. Here it is. This is what we found. And that includes natural language reports from radiologists, say, all right? You take that and then you correlate it to the natural language note data that you're looking for. Did they actually follow up or report this in the note? Yep. And if there's a discordance, then you go, okay, that's the potential for an error or a missed thing.
Yep. And the cool part about this approach is that you can deploy this across an entire health system, entire population, entire country maybe, and like the doctors don't have to do anything. Right?
Like, wait, what?
They just keep practicing, right? Like if you're a doctor, you're a radiologist, you're a physician, you just keep reading your scans, right? And the system's running in background, and you know, once in a while, you know, maybe once a month, you'll miss something really bad. It'll be routed to a thorough system. We'll flag it. It'll be reviewed by subject matter experts in the quality committee, and that's, by the way, the answer to your wife's question.
An expert then looks at it and goes, okay, this was a bullshit lesion. Yeah. It's not a big deal. Yeah. Or this is actually something that was missed.
And so we have like a panel of like three like thoracic radiologists at like our US accounts, and they're the ones who are like this or that. Right.
So it's like Simon Cowell. This was America's Got Talent. That was self-indulgent. This lesion is totally bogus. It's not ever going to grow up to be a cancer. It's not good enough. Doesn't have what it takes. Someone's mother told this lesion, you'll be a cancer, and it believed it, and it's nothing.
We get a lot of those. Or sometimes, you know, AI is not perfect. Sometimes you get like, that's a sinus polyp. How did that image even get into this system? Right. And so,
but a false positive is okay. You're just saying, hey, these are the 20 cases this month where there's a disconnect between what the AI picked up on the CT and the report.
Yep.
Take another look at these. 20. Now, do you develop the AI yourself to identify these lesions on CTs and imaging?
No, actually. So there's so much out there now. I mean, there are so many algorithms. There's so many companies everywhere you look. It's
how many?
700 companies.
700 companies have AI for radiology.
Yeah,
and because it's the lowest hanging.
AI for healthcare. It's AI 500 for radiology.
And this is real AI. It's not like a computer detecting something and then sending it to a human to go, yes, that's a lesion.
I'm sure some of it's that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like algorithms are easy to build now if you have the data, right? Like you just Google has basically open sourced all of TensorFlow, Facebook has all of PyTorch. So you literally just take a data set, you throw it into this like model, and it'll like spit out some predictions.
But they might not be very good. Getting that data can be hard. How many companies are reading x-rays, radiology films with AI to be able to flag things?
Oh man, at least like 40 or 50 that we know of. Yeah.
And you basically just partnered with one of them?
Several of them. Yeah. Okay. And so there's a lot of open source stuff out there. Like the NIH has fantastic data sets for mammography, x-ray, CT scans. And so you can use those data sets to build basic algorithms.
So now here's what my audience will say and what I say. Okay. Yeah. The system, you know, the Skynet decides this lesion is missed and flags it. Next thing you know, there's a pop-up in Epic from the administrator to you going, hey, Dr. Damania, you missed a potentially fatal, you know, lung lesion that was found, that then you never followed up on it. Come to the office of HR for your beating. That's what people are worried about now, because that's not a just culture.
Yep.
That's not a root cause analysis. That's not looking at, you know, the chart. You know, was this area malicious? What was going on? Was the system there? Would reasonable authorities also miss this? You know, there's a whole process.
It's absolutely the wrong approach to patient safety. Just beat down the individual.
Right.
Look, we got to take individual responsibility. We want to learn. Look, people want to do better. When you tell them you missed something, they feel horrible.
They feel terrible.
We don't need to beat them up and fire them and scold them and ridicule them. Let's look at the system.
Yeah.
And
plus, we don't report errors if we're beaten up and scolded.
We don't even talk about it except in the locker room.
That's true. And then it's like this really deep kind of like, you know, you go to the lounge and you're just like, dude, so then I think I killed this patient. And it's the worst you know, I had a text from a friend the other day, and it was, again, why are you texting me? I haven't talked to you in a long time. And it was an error that was made. And just, you could just feel through the text, like they were making a joke to try to disarm it. But I was like, this is hard. I've made these mistakes. And so how do you think, you know, I mean, that's got to be a challenge for you, because you're going to get resistance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's probably the biggest challenge that we face off with a lot of this. Because if you're a rank and file radiologist or doctor, like, you are very concerned about Skynet, Big Brother, all that. You have, like, basically, one is you have to basically, as a company, have a very, very strong stance on this. Yeah. And so we are very firm that, like, when we generate reports, the doctor's name's not involved, right? The process of review is objective and blinded, etc. Right, and then they can go look the doctor up. They can find it.
Right.
But as much as possible, we kind of separate out that the component of measurement tracking. You know, you made a mistake, right? And it's all routed through the quality committee and stays within the department. So we never allow it to rise up to leadership in a way that can target individual physicians. So there's technology and product changes you can make there.
Could this apply to nursing, frontline nursing? So administration of drugs. This is what was ordered. This is what was given. This, you know, could that be the same thing?
Yeah, I think it could be. The thing with like a lot of these, like the biggest benefits of the EHR actually have been realized in, like, you know, computerized order entry, right? So like, actually you've had a dramatic reduction in the rate of these sort of like medication errors.
Handwriting errors, transcription errors. Yeah.
But like what that's meant is there's so much more data. Right. So diagnostic errors are rising. You know, diagnostic errors are now probably one of the leading causes of errors now that these kind of like very basic medication, you know, types of errors have reduced.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think they're rising, or do you think we're just catching them more because we're focusing on them? What do you think it is?
I if you look at the average radiologist and how their practice today is different than the practice like 10 years ago, they're reading like 13 times as many images.
Really?
Right?
Keep going.
Yep. Their reimbursements have dropped by 35%. And so they're spending like 3-4 seconds per image powering through, and every single year they have to read like another 10 more CT scans per day or whatever just to stay even. And so it's definitely getting worse.
So what Pelu is saying is actually spot on, and in the experience of my wife. So my wife, worked at Stanford years ago. We left for 7 years, came back. The volume is so high now. And even with fellows and residents, she's coming home and working from home with her big ass screens. And the kids are like, but mom, normally you read us this stuff and you do violin with us and daddy's an asshole. And it's true. And on top of that, I've heard stories from people who've come out of academics. They go to, say, Las Vegas, to one of these big volume mills in Las Vegas. I won't name names. And they said that they were forced to read so many films that they stopped, even like on chess films, that they stopped looking at bones because there wasn't enough time. And that's part of how you read a film. So of course you're going to miss stuff. We're human beings, right? So that pressure is remarkable.
And I worry about losing that dialogue between the clinician and the radiologist, because that is invaluable. Certainly in my practice, that's invaluable. What do you think? And could it be this? And there's a history of this. And and the radiologists love that dialogue.
They do. They absolutely do. And you think that they don't. You think they're these kind of moles, these naked mole rats that sit in the thing. But that was yesterday's conversation. That was yesterday. Pelu made a face like, huh? Naked mole rat. But the idea that they actually thrive on clinical information. It's garbage in, garbage out. Well, they don't want to make a mistake.
I mean, workplace happiness, according to Maslach, is driven by feedback from the recipients of your services. And radiologists struggle, right? People don't come up and say, thank you for reading that normal chest x-ray. That was
it really reassured me, right?
It really allowed us to proceed to surgery without any, people don't give it. And when you do tell them, hey, so that nice. Was. Oh my,
like, I felt warm when you said that.
I mean, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever gone to a radiologist and said, you know what? It turns out that was appendicitis. We did the operation, so you were correct.
Yeah.
They love that feedback.
Yeah.
They love that feedback.
And they love tough questions and clinicians that seem engaged, and it's been lost. Yeah. It's kind of like our doctor's lounge is gone. Like, we don't have a doctor's lounge. So now we don't get to share these stories and commiserate with each other and communalize our pain and do all the things that we used to do. So, you know what? I'm officially offering ZDog Industries as the virtual doctor's lounge.
There's no doctor's lounge in the hospital because there's no CPT code now for lounging out.
you can't bill for granola bar not otherwise specified, right? It's interesting. So I want to ask you this, though, because what you're doing is you're creating a backstop. You're saying, okay, and I suspect, if I'm reading between the lines, if you had your way and that technology grew, it would do more and more and more to keep us safer. And then it would start to butt up against where humans go, but what about us? But I don't think we can ever be, it's going to take a long time. People don't realize how primitive this AI still is, right? Because you're working in it.
Yeah.
Tell us how close we are to Skynet.
We are so, so far. I mean,
What is Skynet?
Skynet is the Terminator movie. So it's the AI that became sentient and launched a nuclear strike, destroyed humanity, created a robot army that went back in time to try to kill Sarah Connor.
Yep.
Yeah, more or less. That's the one. Oh,
yeah. We just ruined Terminator for a whole generation.
For like five people that haven't seen it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like all the data that you see out there for like AI that's superhuman, it's so like, well, we had this one specific GE scanner that we did like 500,000 mammograms on. And like we had, so this AI is perfect for this one scanner. It's not scalable, and it still does really stupid things if you just like poke it slightly with a stick. And so like you can't trust patient care to that, because it's just gonna like, oh, that's a Philips scanner, and like throw up on it, right?
Interesting.
So there's all this stuff. And then also there's all these issues around like how do you balance for ethnic populations, right? Like African-American mammograms versus Asian mammograms versus Caucasian mammograms, all different densities, they all have different rates of cancer.
Thank you.
And so anything that's gonna be And all the algorithms are trained on Caucasian women. And so like Asian women end up getting overdiagnosed, African-American women get underdiagnosed. Like, there's so many problems here. Sorry.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. And actually sitting in that seat was David Magnus, bioethicist at Stanford, who is an AI expert on the bioethics of AI. And he said exactly that. He goes, when you feed it information from a Caucasian population and it comes out, it's going to be skewed information. Mm-hmm. And how about this? How about you ask it a question? How do we save healthcare costs? The AI will, by definition, bias itself against African Americans, because in the data set, African Americans cost more because of the social determinants of health that are failing them. No. So this is why garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you said that there are these limitations, because people seem to think that AI is going to become sentient all of a sudden and we're all out of a job. But that's not how this works. We need to embrace and grow the stuff that's going to take the human error off the plate, allow us to do what we do uniquely, which is be human.
And in theory, you could reproduce what we're doing right now with Ferrum, with like you know, an army of med students, right? You just teach them all how to look for lung nodules, and every single scan you perform, you just have them check for lung nodules, right? That's not the operator at the top of your license. So I think what AI can do is you think about like the stuff that if you had unlimited labor and a limited workforce that was just like, you know, like a first year med student at best, what could you do, right? And so that's kind of, with Ferrum, that's kind of the approach we took.
Have you thought about the what we call in public health the moral hazard of something that makes something, it makes a system safer? So in other words, if you have a lawnmower that changes the tipping point so it can handle, you know, a higher angle slope, people will drive it to the edge of the lawnmower's limits and will still tip at the same frequency. That's the moral hazard theory. And so, you know, maybe with seatbelts, people drive more hazardously.
I'm getting in trouble with some of our companies. You know how mammography CAD, these AI to help figure out what breast cancer is there, right? You know how it's supposed to be used is the doctor reads the image first independently. Once they're done reading it and writing the note, they then press a button and it turns on this CAD system that like highlights things that they may have missed. And then they go in and adjust the note, right? Like what actually happens is they just turn it on at the beginning, look at what it points at them, and they move on.
Oh my God.
And so studies have shown that like physicians, and this is studies out of like, I think like Harvard and like Seattle and stuff. Doctors that use CAD actually do worse. They have lower specificity, lower sensitivity than those who don't.
It's the moral hazard.
Moral hazard.
And so they're getting paid because they pay for CAD. So you get like $35 or something like that per time you use CAD reimbursed. And they're getting paid to be lazier and deliver worse care. Some of that's limitations of the AI, right? And the AI is getting better. And so it will improve, but you're absolutely right. And so for us, the approach we're taking has a fundamental safeguard to that, right? It's not going straight back to the doctor where they can just like kind of click them and be like, well, it's probably normal since the AI said so. It's going to like a, you know, an area that like at least has some level of guardianship. It's not administrators who can slap you on the wrist, but it is, you know, your peers, the subject matter experts, the kind of radiologists who are, you know, are around you. And it's one of those things that like, people don't get very often, but it's so critical.
Oh man, I couldn't agree more. You know the earliest example of AI that you would this moral hazard issue is the Hewlett-Packard algorithm on the EKG machine. So the auto reading EKG, and it's like you as a medical student, you grab that EKG off and you're like, "Well, it looks like AFib with aberrancy."
You know? Did you read the interpretation? Oh no, what's that say?
No, I mean, right. Oh, what's that say? And then you look at it, it says nothing like AFib with aberrancy, right? And he's like, well, but because, so explain why that is. Well, the P waves are what? So this is a real phenomenon because humans are humans and we're only as good as our incentives.
Yeah.
And so we have to do some engineering to make sure that we.
Well, the other thing is that, and I feel like this is something that I've become like, I've just had to come to terms with is, I feel like the only tools that you can get doctors to use now with the time that they have and the precious, precious minutes they have in their day are tools that make them more productive.
Yeah.
Like I actually think that if you ask healthcare to have its doctors trade off 5% of their time in productivity for 5% better quality, your company will never get off the ground.
Yeah.
So if the only thing doctors can buy or use are productivity solutions, then how do you fix quality? Right. And so like that was one of those things I kept getting frustrated by with my first company because I kept trying to develop tools and products that would deliver higher quality care.
Yeah.
I could never get them into the doctor's workflow and have them actually use it. And that was one of those things I was like, oh, it's because like quality is a system level issue. It's not a physician level issue.
What a great insight, actually. People should listen to that carefully who are trying to start companies and things like that, because that's one of the most important insights.
And you do meet clinicians every now and then who don't really care. Their heart's not in it. And the reality is it's both, right? It's the system primarily, I believe, and it's the individual. It's personal responsibility. It's caring. And it's both, right? When somebody does something carelessly, you better believe we're telling them, look, you have a personal responsibility to do your best. You screwed up. Now, I've done it myself. We're not going to blame you, you know, for everything going wrong. We should have a safe system to pick up on this. But it's both systems and personal responsibility.
Agree. And it's interesting because the comments are fascinating too. So somebody actually asked, Amy Gunmanson asked, male versus female, is there a difference in how they behave? And you know, one thing that David Magnus kind of implied to me is that we could solve most medical malfeasance, in other words, intentional fraud and evil activity, like an oncologist pretending to find cancers and treating with chemo because they're getting paid, by only letting women into medical school.
With the idea they're more conscientious in general.
And the data shows that they commit these malfeasances at an almost infinitesimally small rate. And then there's the theory that, well, that's because they're always afraid of rocking the boat because the hierarchy is so awful and they don't want to have the bring attention and so on. So this is a very complicated, interesting kind of scenario. Mm. Yeah.
What med student rotations do you have to finish up to get your MD degree? Oh.
He was telling me. But yeah, they're good ones too. Yeah.
I got to do a psychiatry sub at Paul Tevye, which I.
It's a good. That's fun. You'll learn a lot. Love.
Yeah, exactly. You actually have an opportunity to learn because you have a little time and space.
Right.
Pathology elective. Step 2 CK and CS, and ACLS, and then I'm done.
Okay. So I think what's going to kick your ass is ACLS, frankly.
We can do it now if you want.
Yeah, we'll do it right now.
I've learned it like 4 times, and it's different every time.
Dude, we should totally fuck with him and be like, yeah, so Britillium is the first line agent for...
You have to know what chromosome hereditary dwarfism is on your ACLS exam.
Oh, if I saw that, that would just kill me.
It would kill you. Yeah, so here's another question, though, because I get the sense, and I don't get this with a lot of engineer types, that you have a very high emotional intelligence that
fake it really well.
Yeah, or you fake it really well, right? Yeah. That's a real thing. So I know people in the top echelons of tech companies who have learned to fake that well. They've read books like The Game by Strauss and these guys, because The Game is basically written by psychopaths on how to manipulate people. And so they're able to fake a degree of emotional intelligence and so on. But I get the sense yours is genuine. What is keeping you up at night? What's hurting you? What's causing you pain? Because I know that founders of these companies are under more stress than people understand, having been one myself. What is it like for you? Because you're young, you're only 31.
Yep. I actually make a joke with a lot of my founder friends whenever we, you know, kvetch about being founders, and it's like, listen, like I'm doing this company, you know, we're like trying to fix this massive cost of, like, we have an opportunity to really change the world here. Like, if it doesn't go anywhere, I must do like a RCM, NLP, billing, coding, analytics, optimization company, and just like become a million. Like screw, like this is the last shot that I'm going to give healthcare to try to help it. Because it's so hard. It's so hard to fix. There's so much inertia. And you know, like, and so you have to look for these narrow windows of opportunity where, like, cool, like, I can do good. I can like find medical errors. And the thing in the fee-for-service world is, like, most of the time you improve quality, it actually costs money.
Costs money because there's less complications to treat. Yeah.
And one of the insights we had was, like, actually, like, when you miss a diagnosis of cancer or an aortic aneurysm or an infection, right? Like, you actually, that's a really damaging financial situation for the hospital. I mean, it's just not just like the malpractice risk in the lawsuit. The average lung cancer lawsuit is $1.3 million.
Oh my God.
Right? And so, like, you know, we're finding hundreds of these at our hospitals. So, like, there's a lot of money there. Also, if you're missing hundreds of cancers, that's millions of dollars of downstream revenue that you could be making for the hospital. And so we're like, okay, wait, like, actually, this is like the only place in quality, the only opportunity we have to improve healthcare quality that like hospitals can buy.
Right.
And you know, I've been looking at the kind of the sector for a really long time, and there are very few opportunities like that. Usually you're either making more money for insurers, making money for hospitals, or you're a quality solution that is too kumbaya to survive in the real world. Like, those are the three kind of actual companies.
You're in a bunch of hospitals, right? You're actually in what, 15 hospitals?
Yeah, 12 hospital systems around the world, including the largest hospital in the world. Chang'an Memorial Hospital in Taipei.
Oh, wow.
Guess how many beds they have.
So Stanford's like 500, 600 beds? Yeah.
2,000.
I'm going to say 800.
10,000 beds.
What?
It's like a city. It's like a, yeah.
Oh, my God.
How many occupants of those beds need to be in a bed?
Right. Well, because this is Taipei's single payer.
The cataract
patient.
They're
just a piece on this. Yeah.
Taiwan's healthcare system is... It's like the most efficient system in probably like the world.
Yeah,
they have like best, like top decile like cancer outcomes, and they spend an average of their average cancer patient. I was meeting with their Ministry of the Health Insurance Agency. The average cancer patient they spend $3,000 a year on.
That's crazy.
And they have like top decile results.
So there was a recent article about this that I shared on my page, actually, about Taipei or Taiwan's single payer system. It's very efficient, but the doctors are very unhappy as a rule because they're the least staffed in like the developed world or something like that. And so they work really hard. Yeah. So they quoted one doctor saying, Taiwan's system is a heaven for patients because there's a minimal copay. Everybody gets seen for anything, but there may be a wait, but it's not that bad. And it's hell for doctors. So it's kind of interesting. So you always have a trade-off with that. Yeah. But But so, sorry, we were talking about something. Oh, he's being in multiple hospitals. Oh, it gets back to what Chris Jones, the hospital venture guy we had on the show yesterday was talking about, which is, why can't we pay for things that actually make care better and don't have to think about these horrible conflicts that you're having? And I made a comment to Amy Baxter 2 days ago about healthcare attracts the D-list business talent. Now, why is that? Why is that? Because a guy like Pelu, who's super smart, who cares about people, could make money so much easier doing like billing, like a natural language processing for billing codes. And so why not just go work in investment banking or something like that? And that's what a lot of them do. And then we're left with people who don't really understand business that well. And then we have a guy like you that's like struggling to fight against the culture. And it's really hard.
Saving lives.
Saving lives.
You're in Sutter Health as much as we body slammed Sutter Health.
Constantly. And I worked for Sutter.
Antitrust practices and price gouging. They paid $575 million in a settlement because of price gouging and antitrust practices. We hit them for that. But they're actually
doing something amazing.
Just to our point earlier about, you know, we were talking about the groups in healthcare you think you can vilify, turns out there's amazing people working in those systems.
And I think that's the key here is the vast majority of healthcare is risk averse. They're driven by fear. They're followers. They basically wait until the last possible moment that they have to do something to do it, right? And so but there are those people out there. There are people who they are in healthcare because for personal reasons, for, you know, like ethical reasons, they want to improve things, and you just have to actually find them. And oftentimes they are the ones who are in positions of power, maybe not the very top, but they might be departmental chairs. They might be, you know, regional leaders. They might be hospital CEOs. And they are actually oftentimes willing to just like bulldog stuff through because they do have that moral compass. And they're basically going to be our first, you know, 10, 20 customers. Right.
This is so important for people to hear because it's absolutely true. You find the passionate progressive advocates within those organizations. Like me and Marty would never be able to do speaking if there weren't advocates within these organizations, because we're a bit on the maverick side, on the fringes of that.
Pushing the field.
That's how you like to cause it. I'm like burning all down to the ground. But the people who get it are the progressive. They push it through, and then you go and they realize, wow, that's a thing. Yeah. And that's what you're trying to do.
And actually, one of the things that's really fun for me is that like oftentimes you think about like who are the techno trailblazer AI enthusiasts who are like, you know, like going out there and like coding, and like those aren't actually our staunchest champions, right? The people who are like, holy crap, this is really cool. They're like the doctor leaders who somehow, despite being 65, still have a little bit of, you know, hope and optimism and idealism. And like, we find them there, right?
But I see them all the time.
Yeah.
You see them too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we both travel a lot. I mean, we see it all the time. Take hope, you guys. Like, this is, we're so full of despair, you know?
Well, that's why I just think it's so cool. Sutter Health is adopting your technology. I mean, Sutter Health is this system that has done things that we've criticized for price gouging, and yet they're leading the way in patient safety, adopting, believing in what you're doing, saying, hey, we're going to make the investment, spend money, even though there may not be a financial case, because it could help patients.
I think the reason why we're able to actually get even these fee-for-service accounts is because there is a massive financial case to fixing medical errors when it's a diagnostic omission. Right. When it's a cancer that you missed.
Yeah.
That's a lot of kind of opportunity to provide more care. Also, it's a lot of opportunity to not get sued. And, you know, most hospital systems definitely want to avoid these lawsuits. Like that's like they happen all the time. Yeah. They get a ton of press. There's a sad patient face on the cover. Like, it's the worst for these administrators. And so we're able to both appeal to the fear and risk aversion of a lot of systems, and also these, you know, like key champions who are optimists, who are, you know, trying to move things forward. But I feel like it's a little bit of like the, you got to have the positive message, and you have to have this like aspirational ideal. And then like, you do need some of this,
Practical yeah, stuff. Exactly. So that was our, you know, when I was running Turntable, our whole thing was preventative primary care, team-based, more expensive than standard primary care, but reduces downstream costs. Well, who's going to hate that? Hospitals, because hospitals are getting 50% less admissions from our patients. Specialists, because they're not going to get to do all the usual bogus referrals that they don't need because our guys practice at the top of their license, and gals. So you're starting to hurt people that are making a lot of money. Whether they do this consciously or not, mm-hmm. they will start to resist. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but you just won't even get the meetings.
Yep.
And I think that was the big, and you know, go to a self-funded employer, they're paying all the bills. They don't want a medical error. They don't want, you know, they don't want any of this. And yet their TPA that administers the plans is like working with United Health. And it turns out United Health wants to own all of it. So they don't want to outsource it to somebody else. Now you have a $20 billion monolith opposing what you do because it will mess up their global domination plans. These are good people in bad systems, by the way. I know a lot of people at United that are fantastic people. Mm-hmm. But as a thing, if you own the PBM, you own the doctors, you own the insurance, okay, what can't you do? Well, you can't not make a shit ton of profits every single fucking day. So I'm off my soapbox. Sorry, I get a little.
I'm just like a little sulking about it. I'm just trying to build a company here, guys. Like,
I don't even want to be associated with that rant.
No.
Are you in the three comma club?
No. Do you have the doors that go like this, or the doors that go like this?
Two lousy commas.
Healthcare founder. You don't go into healthcare for the money, and you especially don't try to improve quality in healthcare for the money.
That's 100% true.
Yeah.
So how are you doing? You live in the city.
Yeah.
And you're a young guy. I'm going to ask all kinds of personal questions now, right? Yeah. You don't have to answer them if you don't want to, but you better, because otherwise my audience is going to make fun of you. By the way, one audience member, Daniel Handian, who's an intern in family medicine, said he really respects your collar game. He thinks you have three collars going and they look hot.
He's a Jersey guy, actually.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Me too. Where in Jersey?
South Brunswick, so around Princeton Central.
Yeah. Nice. Morristown.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. We're homies. So are you married?
No.
No, and
not to a person, but to your startup. You probably are
my one true love, my company.
How much sleep do you get each day?
Actually, I'm one of those people who cannot function without decent
sleep.
Value
it.
Yeah, it's mainly just that I'm useless without it. Actually, I had a major breakthrough. Apparently, I grind my teeth like none other.
Yeah,
and I started wearing a mouth guard, and I've gotten the best sleep I've gotten in a long, long time. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So between mouth guard and obstructive sleep apnea, people get terrible sleep.
Yeah.
So it's good that you figured that out.
Yeah.
Now notice how successful and productive you are. You get enough sleep. Yeah. So it's almost like, well, I'm too successful and productive. I can't get enough sleep. No, you will never be successful and productive unless you get enough sleep.
Silicon Valley definitely fetishizes the concept of the 4 hour, CEO. That's the people I know who do that. They burn out in 3-4 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Shorter lifespans.
And then there's Elon Musk. So,
he's a different. Yeah. Yeah, cocaine is a hell of a drug. Yeah. I made that up. I have no evidence of that. It just feels right.
Tesla's stock price just.
Yeah, this is a market moving show, right?
That's right. Yeah. We're on Animal Planet on all the major networks.
Yeah, I think they're gonna call us back.
So you're doing okay? Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like, the main reason any of us does any of this is because we actually feel like we can change stuff. And so for me, the thing that wakes me up every day is we have dashboards that show all of the radiologist confirmed medical errors that are being detected and addressed, all the follow-ups, all these patients who have, cancer that we're actually diagnosing early instead of missing it. And that's something that's a personal story for not just me, but a lot of people on our team and a lot of people probably in the audience have these stories of a family member who had breast cancer that was missed, or, someone who had pancreatic cancer that was missed. It's shocking how often I talk to people who are, red meat eating venture capitalists, and I'll tell them this story. They'll be like, oh, wow. My father actually had the story. I'm not gonna invest in you because I don't believe in the whole quality shtick, but this is deeply personally touching for me.
They're a human being for 1 minute. They become a human being.
For 1 minute.
Snap back.
And then they're back into the suit. With the duck tie. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, we see it all the time, right? In surgical oncology, we see people that are, seeing us after they look back and realize, hey, a year ago, I went to the emergency room with a little jaundice, and they just gave me some antibiotics saying it was a little infection. And they realize you see all these sort of regrets. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is public information, even though he was, came to Johns Hopkins, but Steve Jobs had a lot of regrets about his care, yeah. right? And he, people have a lot of regrets when they realize, hey, things could have been done differently.
Yeah, and he also he did. And there was a lot of things even in the book about, naturopathic stuff. And let me ask you a question. This is kind of unrelated, but not entirely. So are you seeing more pancreatic cancer than you used to?
The incidence is about the same. About 40,000 people a year die from pancreatic cancer, and that has really not changed in the last several decades.
Mm.
And our survival rate is still very poor.
So I hear from so many people on the kind of front lines, they say, we're seeing more of it, and maybe it's perceptual, but it doesn't look like it's translating into...
When people get pancreatic cancer, oftentimes they are not cured. They struggle with the cancer for 3 to 5 years. And they're not cured and out there. Very few are cured and out there. People are a little older than, say, breast cancer patients. There are so many breast cancer survivors that they're out there in the world telling people, hey, I went through this. We need more detection. We need more research. We need to do a car wash and a dance-a-thon and a comb and run. We don't have that in pancreatic cancer, even though about the same number of people die each year from breast cancer as they do from pancreatic cancer. Mm. You would think the incidence of pancreatic cancer death rates are, that it's equal or it's 10 times higher because we spend more than 10 times the money on breast cancer research than we do on pancreatic cancer research. Mm. So when Alex Trebek gets pancreatic cancer, we think, it's good to have a visible spokesperson who can talk about, and it's not good he got cancer, but it's good that people realize,
That's it's very, very similar to the challenges that medical errors have as well. And that no one ever people don't feel like they died of a medical error. They feel like they died of the lung cancer. They died of, the aortic aneurysm, right? And so you don't have medical error awareness marches or foundations for medical errors, right? Mm. But so that the actual funding in the space, the even attention that's being given is even compared to any of these cancers, is basically non-existent.
Well, you're seeing it with the opioid epidemic.
Yeah. People are going really hard on that.
Yeah.
Medical errors. You're right. You don't have a pink ribbon and you go walking around the street. And I think doctors would be very uncomfortable with a medical error march.
Yep.
And nurses would be very uncomfortable with a medical error march. But we ought to be the ones leading the march. Mm-hmm. Help us make less errors.
Yep.
It's ironic. We debate, are medical errors the third or fourth leading cause of death in the United States? We don't know, right? It's somewhere in there. These are all estimates, but it's ironic. Medical error. So the number one cause of death in the United States in people under 50 is prescription opioids.
Yep. Mm.
Aren't most of those deaths due to medical errors? People getting opioids they should have never gotten that I prescribed for years with good intentions and bad science. Medical errors are really, they have many manifestations. Yep. And if we can just stop blaming individuals and say, hey, look, this system promoted inappropriate opioid prescribing and it promoted missing things. And it burn out doctor. When doctors are burnt out, when they have this moral injury, they're far more likely to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah. Cause we're depersonalized from the root of what we do. And also I think we are already beating ourselves up. So already it's about us. It's not about a systems issue where we fit in a system. It's about me in a silo suffering and what's going to make my life better. So yeah, I think that's incredibly important. And again, we have to start to talk about these as systems. And people, you'll see even in the comments when we do a show about that Vanderbilt nurse that missed that accidentally gave Vecuronium instead of Versed in a scanner and paralyzed a patient to death in a scanner. I mean, it's the worst way to die. So already you have a second victim effect where the person who made the mistake feels like a murderer. And then second, she was fired, which is not the correct course of action, and then criminally prosecuted for second-degree murder or something by Tennessee, or I forget where it was. It was around Vanderbilt, so it would have been Nashville or something. And how when we did that story and I advocated for actually a just culture approach to that, a lot of people in the comments were like, this woman's a murderer and she should hang and she should feel terrible. And okay, so you want people to actually go into medicine when that's how you're treated when you make a mistake? That's crazy.
Who's not a murderer in healthcare if she's a murderer?
Exactly.
We've all made a mistake that's adversely affected.
Except patients. For him, because he hasn't graduated yet.
Even though he's been blamed for many mistakes.
I was a med student at Santa Clara Valley when they were switching from paper to Epic, and so I'm pretty sure.
You were there when they did that? Dude, I used to practice. I used to work at the Valley as a resident.
So yeah. I'm pretty sure I had plenty of opportunities during that time period to do terrible things that no one realized.
You know what made the Valley? The Valley was awesome because it was on paper. So you could go there and you could be blah, 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 and you die, and it was great. Now, sure, there were probably errors, but I feel like the patients got better care.
What was more traumatic?
Back to paper.
What was more traumatic, watching the transition to Epic or watching your first baby delivery?
Oh.
This is gonna sound bad. Oh, the transition to Epic was just so. So I had a patient who was like in like DKA, like in the ED at Valley, and like I basically ordered like the stuff for him like three times, and like went to check in him, like never got it. And because the nurse was like, well, like the patient like doesn't exist in the system. And so this guy was like sitting there for like hours.
Hours of this.
Yeah.
There are new errors that are introduced by electronic medical records. They're unique errors, and they're systems and they're preventable errors. Yep.
Ordering on the wrong patient, for example. Oh,
constantly. Yeah. I've written notes on the wrong patient. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a crime because that's a billing problem. Mm-hmm. Right.
That's when it becomes a crime. Yeah, exactly.
That's when it's a crime. That's when the administrators bring you in. Look, we know you've killed several patients through medical errors. Yeah. We don't care about that because the complications keep us in business. It's the billing that you screwed up.
Well, the thing that the way that I think about it sometimes is imagine if a solution like ours that finds let's say 5% of lung cancer patients who have their lesions missed, we find it earlier, it improves outcomes. Think about what the 5-year survival rate improvement would be to patients, and how much we could charge for this as a drug if.
Wow!
Right, yeah. And it's why are the incentives not in the same place here if you can have technology that.
Now you're thinking about this a lot. Now you're thinking like those douchebags in suits at JPM, man. That's good.
And you like the TV show Silicon Valley.
It's everyone who is, here. It's way too close to home sometimes.
Every single person I've talked to in Silicon Valley who's in tech will not watch that because it's too close to home. And it's funny because I've had these experiences that are fresh out of that show. I mean, just 100%. Like people say things to me and I'm like, that's a line from Russ Hanneman or that, it's ridiculous.
Or the concert with Flo Rida.
In the very beginning.
I've been to several of those during the course of my past two couple companies.
Have you hit balls at Pac Bell Park? Or?
Yes, I have.
Of course you
yes,
have.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, that's amazing. Have you ever?
My investors have had you there.
Yes.
Yes.
To court you and to, talk about how they want to
actually
invest.
Honestly, the main reason was because there were 3 years where Google Glass was the shit. And so we were the Google Glass company.
I remember that. Yeah. Google Glass, everyone was talking about the glass holes walking around San Francisco.
Yeah.
So,
and now here I am, I'm a pariah for trying to talk about medical errors in healthcare. So it's the whole other
shoe nut. Dude, you will never, and with my crowd, you will never be a pariah. You will be celebrated and we will advocate for you and fight for you what you're doing because it's unbelievable. And also, I believe you can be your own Jin Yang if you try hard enough.
Suck it, Jin Yang.
Suck it, Jin Yang. No.
Do you see when the investor gets up at the Flo Rida concert and no one's dancing, no one even knows who this guy is, and the head investor goes, I want to thank you, there's refreshments in the back, and I want to thank Mr. Florence.
Florida?
Florid. I want to thank Florid. No idea who this guy is.
Yeah. It's the story of the Valley, man.
Somebody says, hey, this is a great idea. I want to get this at my hospital. They can do what?
How do they find you?
Shoot me an email. Go to our website, ferrumhealth.com. If you really want to seem hip, ferrum.ai. It's still live. Pelu, P-E-L-U-F, ferrumhealth.com. And honestly, the cool part about what we're doing is this is a system solution. It's integrated system level. So we don't need to go door to door to doctors, right? We at Sutter and at Austin or the other site that we're deployed at, we're live in half a day across their entire kind of imaging volume.
Wow, so it's low startup.
Yeah,
problem.
So plug and play. Yeah. And they can start finding these patients that they're missing every single day, every single week. They could find them tomorrow.
Are you hearing stories of patients whose lives are saved because of your technology?
We have dozens of these narratives now, right? Like like you mentioned, like the grandmother who slipped and fell, broke her hip, went to the ED, got a pan CT for trauma, and then had a recurrence of her breast cancer that was not caught. Because again, it's not the doctor's fault. this person is here for trauma. Like, you're not going to spend all your time pouring through the hundreds of slices that don't have to do with trauma. And so all these errors that makes sense. And another type of error is the ED doc, who the last thing they want to deal with is remembering to schedule a follow-up scan in 6 months for this patient. And so it's a system, right?
Yeah.
And so we're seeing, every single one of our sites has dozens of these stories, and it's just building and building and building. So
I love it.
I love it, man. Yeah. This is I really enjoy it.
Creativity, a young medical student mind.
Youth creativity, medicine, business, science, AI, everything. AI. Click all the boxes.
This pen has AI in it.
It does. It's artificial ink.
Sell me this pen. Raise me $10 million Series A with this pen.
With this pen. I bet I could do it. Oh, man. What a pleasure, Pelu. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
For everybody who's watching, I'm going to address the camera for a second. First of all, I want to thank Marty McCary for a week of amazing...
It's been awesome.
It's so fun, and we got to hang out quite a bit. We got to make fun of JPM. Did you, by the way, did you see, this is the last little bit, you see the article in Bloomberg, so all the JPM people, all the investors are bitching that San Francisco is full of squalor and homeless people, and it's messing up their game. And so they come here... 10,000 of them descend on the city. They raise the hotel rates to $2,000 a night and $125 an hour for a table at a meeting space in the Marriott. And then they say, I don't understand why it's so filthy. Next time we're going to do it in Vegas. And these are the people who are sucking the money out of an inefficient healthcare system, out of the wages of the people that are now on the street. And then they have the fucking nerve to come and say, yeah, this place is a shithole. Now, it is a shithole. Don't get me wrong.
But it's my shithole.
But it's my shithole. Exactly.
Well, I think the hot new thing now is actually they're doing these private events around JP Morgan before and after, that are in Napa now. So they're going to Napa for a few days, and they
come
here, hold their nose, and then they go back to Napa afterwards. Oh, so it's fantastic.
It's really, and you and me both lived in the city. You live in the city. Yeah. And it is true. It's true. San Francisco has huge challenges, and it has to do with wealth and equity. And look, you know me. I'm not a communist or some kind of wacko. I'm just saying there's got to be a way to raise everybody up while not knocking down people who are working very hard like yourself, right? So there are ways to do that. We got to figure out.
You know, if there were two farmers in the United States, say, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, one might work twice as hard as the other. One might make two or three times the other farm. But one farmer does not make 2,000 times 2,000 more than the next farm for working relatively similar.
We want people to do well for working hard, but we don't want that kind of inequity. So I'll read a few comments on the way out. Ashley says, another amazing interview. Meyer Kosla is a doc. Great talk. Fucking awesome. I like it when my followers talk like I do. And Erica Black says, this week of lives has been great. Very informative. So I love having Marty on the show. I loved having you. Let's go have lunch or do something fun. And you guys hit share, subscribe to the show if you want to support us. We're doing a lot of interesting stuff, and we really love that we're free of all this commercial garbage. And if you're listening on the podcast, just review the damn podcast. People are so lazy. It's like you got to guilt them like NPR. You are in your car and you're enjoying Terry Gross, but Terry Gross is broke. She's broke as fuck. Help Terry Gross be less broke. So please give us some money.
Tote bag.
Is this guy awesome or what?
He's awesome.
Good.
And we out.
We out.
Hit the button, Victoria.